Speed up with podcast speed up.
Rationally Speaking is a presentation of New York City Skeptics, dedicated to promoting critical thinking, skeptical inquiry, and science education. For more information, please visit us at nycskeptics.org.
Welcome to Rationally Speaking, the podcast where we explore the borderlands between reason and nonsense. I'm your host, Julia Galef, and with me is today's guest, Dan Finke. Dan has a PhD in philosophy from Fordham University. He specializes in topics such as ethics and atheism and Nietzsche. He blogs at Camels with Hammers and was for many years a professor of philosophy at various universities and now does online philosophy courses, as well as being a certified philosophy practitioner, using philosophy to help people think through troubling dilemmas and give life advice. Dan, does that sound like the right description of a philosophy practitioner?
Yep, that's about right.
Okay, great. Well, so I want to start this episode by just explaining what the impetus was for me to invite Dan on the show for this particular episode. As I mentioned, Dan blogs quite eloquently about a bunch of different interesting topics, any one of which would honestly have made a great episode. But the impetus for this invite happened to be that about a week ago now, I posted an argument on Facebook about a controversial issue, which I'm sure we'll get to at some point in this episode. And a bunch of people agreed with me, some people disagreed with me, and Dan disagreed with me. But his disagreement was so thoughtful and nuanced and reasonable that it was, you know, on complicated issues, I tend to feel like I have a lot more in common with the people who disagree with me but think the issue is complicated than the people who agree with me and think it's obvious. And Dan definitely fell into that former category. His post gave me a lot of food for thought, which, again, we'll get into the details of later. And we may still disagree to a substantive extent, I'm not sure, but the key point here is that I thought that disagreement on Facebook was just a really nice example of what I wish disagreements over very fraught and controversial topics should look like. So I invited Dan onto the podcast to talk, broadly speaking, about civility in discourse, what the rules for civility should be, when it's sort of warranted and when it's, you know, maybe not as warranted. To talk about taking and giving offense and what the sort of expectations for that should be, what determines those expectations. It's a big field. So maybe a good place to start, Dan, would be to talk about one of, I think, probably your more famous blog posts, which is a civility pledge that you wrote out very carefully and sort of stood behind yourself and encouraged your commenters and readers to stand behind, you know, to take the pledge as well. So maybe you could just explain what that civility pledge is and what motivated it and sort of help readers understand how it jibes with other positions you've taken, like, for example, defending Charlie Hebdo, who certainly does not meet the criteria of civility, I would say.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the thing with the civility pledge was that, to me, being a rationalist and an atheist, the reason I'm at all a public atheist is because I really do take it as a matter of defending a rational approach to the world. And I do feel like religions, being faith-based, have a particularly... not that, of course, all religious people are all irrational or anything overblown like that, but that there are certain parts of religion that are that encourage, you know, subordination of reason to other goods or, you know, faith, etc. And that's what gets me into being in the atheist blogosphere at all, is it concerned with the idea that the most important philosophical matters about ethics and about metaphysics and what we know and who we are and the meaning of life, that these really are rational questions and they're not the province of mythologies, etc., that they should be seen as really rational questions. That doesn't mean only science. I mean, there's philosophy too. And, you know, rigorous philosophical inquiry can be can be really rationally and engage with these things. And so it's that belief in rationalism that really motivates me to be a public writer like this. And so the problem merges where the atheist community I was a part of, often, it, you know, even though it ostensibly says it's about promoting reason, sometimes it engages in tactics which are not really rational, right? They're very emotionalistic. They're very much about demonizing religious people or you know, being really abusive to them in the way that they, you know, they'll call them stupid and insane. And that's problematic to me. And so to me, if we're going to be in the business of promoting reason in the public square, we have to do that by modeling it. And that means modeling an approach which is rational in the way we behave and treat each other, not just saying we're for reason. You know, there's many a Christian who says, why are you against Christianity? Christianity is just about love. Why would you be against love? Mm-hmm. And, you know, like you can't take any institution for what it says it's about. You have to look at how it actually carries itself. Mm-hmm. And the criticisms of Christianity would be in ways it doesn't carry itself with love. And the criticisms of the atheists are where we don't carry ourselves with reason. And what wound up happening was I wound up defending that we have to have a rational approach that puts the priority of reason, the kind of enlightenment ideal, that we persuade each other with reason rather than with force, right? That core sort of intuition was at the core of it. What wound up happening, though, was when I got into talking about social justice issues, about which I was very, very passionately on the side of feminism and LGBT rights, etc., I wound up finding that my commenters no longer, like I had a lot of pushback. I was at Freethought Blogs and I had a lot of pushback where people wanted to attack bigots or perceived bigots and misogynists or at least perceived ones with a kind of vitriolic shaming and just using all sorts of just vicious sort of language about them. And I was basically arguing that, you know, we need to argue humanely even with bigots. And what wound up happening was that I got a lot of pushback and a lot of people making a very good argument to me that when you that in the past a lot of the people we celebrate today as important activists who are clearly on the right side of history, at the time they were called uncivil, etc. And so civility has been a kludge of those with power to keep the marginalized at bay. And so I internalized what was very valuable about that criticism. And I also internalized a lot of, you know, I was also sympathetic because I'm a Nietzschean, and that's a whole other story. I'm sympathetic to the role of the emotions in reasoning and good reasoning, the role of them, that they're not entirely, I mean, as you know, the tireless champion against the straw Vulcan, emotions have a role too, and that's good. So what I wanted to do, and we have to be able to make harsh moral criticisms, I believed that. And so I believe we have to be able to say things that do make people uncomfortable. And so I tried to find that balance of writing a civility pledge that didn't silence the marginalized, but also didn't take the attitude that the marginalized can never be wrong and whatever they do is morally okay, even if it is still abusive.
It is a tricky line to navigate, I think.
That's exactly it. So it's a tricky line. And so I tried to sketch out what I think are principles that can do it in a principled way. And I think what I've seen is that the more I've adhered to it, the more it does work. And the more I see, I could just diagnose countless escalating feuds as their problem being that they don't stick to the principles that I'm trying to lay out here. Now, consistent with that, I do think that there's a room for satirists. I do think that that's a genre. I do think that there's a place for South Park. There's a place for Charlie Hebdo. You know, there's a place for people who are in a particular kind of art form that is about, you know, exposing absurdity and hypocrisy. And there's different rules for them. I mean, South Park is about skewering everybody, and they're fair about that. And if you feel like they were unfair to you, well, they're unfair to everybody. They're on a hyper level of discourse. I can disagree with them while recognizing that their attitude is that they're just skewers, equal opportunity. Same with Charlie Hebdo, and I felt like with Charlie Hebdo, there was a particular emphasis where I do think sometimes there's a bit more latitude to the marginalized, where I don't believe that it's always okay to punch up and it's always wrong to punch down. I think that's too simplistic.
Can you just briefly explain what punching up and punching down are in case?
So a lot of social justice pushback against my civility sort of standards, a lot of people would say, well, you know, as long as jokes are okay if they're punching up, right? If you're punching at the powerful, you can be as mean and unfair and vicious as you want.
Right.
But if you're beating up the marginalized, that's, you know, picking on the weak, and mm-hmm. it's unjust and it's unfair, and it just perpetuates injustice. And there is some truth to that, but I don't think that's it. I do think that satire is about showing absurdity and hypocrisy everywhere, and that there is room to show that even for all of us, because we're all flawed. And but I also do think that sometimes there's some validity to that. Sometimes when the powerful are making fun of the weak, it is just bullying. And sometimes it is just reinforcing a power structure. And sometimes when the marginalized are attacking something powerful, they do deserve a little bit more latitude because of the power asymmetry. And I wanted to focus on the fact that I thought that Charlie Hebdo got really horribly treated by people on the left who saw them as who were basically arguing that they got what they deserved for picking on Muslims.
Are you talking about the statements that began, well, you know, they shouldn't have been murdered, but... And then basically said, you know, they were being horrible bigots and, you know, shouldn't have published what they did.
Yeah, exactly. And I tried to argue that, I tried to argue two ways to kind of thread that needle. One way was that I wanted to argue that they weren't really attacking Muslims. They were attacking Muhammad and Islam. And I do think mm-hmm. that Muhammad and Islam represent religious power that holds power over, you know, at least a billion people in the world. And that's enormous power. And Muslims are not the same thing. So I am protective of your average Muslim in a Western country where there's a lot of bigotry. And I think that the Charlie Hebdo writers and cartoonists were trying to draw that distinction between defending, in many cases, Muslim immigrants, but also claiming the right to speak against the, you know, to satirize the power of religion. And that, if we lose that, then we lose a cornerstone of secular freedoms. And I feel like blasphemy laws and attempts to have secular people defer and not offend religious beliefs out of a fear of violence or out of a feeling like it's inherently wrong to mock a religious belief, that is, to me, accepting the holiness, the separateness and the above-itiveness of a religious belief. And I think that that violates against secular conscience. So I defended Charlie Hebdo. And the other thing is, I defend them purely on free speech grounds. I mean, a lot of the people who violate my civility pledge aren't my, you know, I would still defend their right to do so. And I want to make a clear distinction that when we're talking about how we morally should be civil with one another, that has nothing to do with free speech rights.
Right. That is a very misused term, I think, free speech or censorship. They're sort of the two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, exactly. And let me just say one more word about that, and then whatever, mm-hmm. you know, you can ask me questions. But
great.
The last thing I'd want to say about that is that, yeah, on the private level, it's perfectly valid for us to argue that some sorts of speech are counterproductive to a, you know, to a good discourse. And that's perfectly valid with, I put my money where my mouth is. Every month I have an ongoing donation to the ACLU. Mm-hmm. I support Amnesty International with my money. I mean, I believe in free speech rights. I think it's a different issue when we want to have discourse spaces that are constructive. I do think that a bullying kind of discourse silences people and makes it the loudest and most obnoxious voices win. And I don't think that's actually cultivating civility. I don't think it's cultivating reason or discourse. And I want to make the separation that there's a difference between, like when people claim they're offended, of course, sometimes that's irrational. Sometimes they don't have a good reason. Sometimes they do. And if we get into the attitude that any speech is okay, that if you're offended, it's always the person who's claiming offense's fault, then that's wrong. Basically, I think that there's something C.S. Lewis calls bulverism, where instead of making an argument that your opponent is wrong, you just declare that they're wrong for this good reason, you know, for and diagnose why. So like sometimes that argument is, you know, you're privileged, therefore you're wrong. Instead of here's why you're wrong, and oh, I think I know why, because privilege may be a factor. Your privilege is supposed to be diagnosing your why you're wrong before even proving you're wrong. And similarly, when people say they're morally offended, sure, they could be wrong about being morally offended, but they should first be proven that they shouldn't be offended. The fact that they're offended shouldn't be a reason to diagnose them as easily dismissed. So that's the broad view that I have.
That's a great overview. And I think I'll double click on one of the most recent points you made, which is that people can be wrong to be offended, or they can be unjustified in being offended in some cases, which that rings truer to me than another maybe more common position, which is that, you know, if someone is offended, then they're sort of owed an apology, you know, whether or not you meant to offend them. And I guess the flip side of that position, which is also a common position in its own right, is that, you know, offense is just this subjective thing, and like some people are going to be offended and other people aren't, and it's sort of an aesthetic taste almost, and it doesn't mean that like no one is owed an apology for having been offended. Essentially, they should just, you know, deal with it or decide not to be offended or whatever. But that's not on the person whose you know, words caused the offense. And so your position feels more correct to me. But I've had trouble figuring out how to apply it in practice, because there's a lot of, I think the most interesting case, like tricky case, is when there is a joke or a satire or something that can be interpreted, maybe was intended as being a satire of something racist or, you know, misogynist, or you know, otherwise bad. But many people interpret it as actually being racist or misogynist. Maybe a good example is the New Yorker magazine cover that had it was a political cartoon of a sort of Islamic militant imagined version of Barack and Michelle Obama doing like a terrorist fist bump. And Michelle Obama has like a Black Panther reminiscent fro. And, you know, to me, it was clear that this was, or it seemed clear at least, that this was a satire. It was making fun of people who view everything, even the most innocuous fist bump that Barack and Michelle Obama do, as being a sign that they're, you know, secretly Islamic and terrorists. But many people thought it was racist. And I think even, you know, understanding that maybe the people who created it didn't mean it that way, that they meant to be satirizing that view instead of promoting it, they still felt like it was offensive. And I've run into this a bunch of times where, yeah, same kind of format. And I don't know how to argue that people shouldn't be offended. It certainly feels to me that they shouldn't be offended, but I don't know what kind of argument to make in a principled way. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I really, that one's a fine line for me. I think that one is going to come down to debates about the specifics of whether that particular satire is more perpetuating the problem than skewering it.
And is that about intent or about the effects? Like how it could reasonably be expected to be interpreted by the people who consume it?
Yeah, and I think that's the question. I think it's a really good question. So let me just kind of, let me try it through a back door, because I don't know how to hit it right on the head. So I'll come in the back door and talk about the larger context of the intents versus effects, right? So in the social justice internet, you often hear that intent is not magic, right?
Right.
And what they want to say is that, you know, if you, just the fact that you say you didn't intend it doesn't mean that you still don't hurt someone, or that you're not, perpetuating something bad. And I think that in those situations, they make a good point. And there are some people who, they call it like the Schrodinger's, it's like a Schrodinger's joke, where like, it wasn't, it, you know, where someone will make a sexist or a racist joke, but whether or not they were only kidding depends on whether or not people get offended.
Right.
You know? Yeah. So there's a lot of insincerity there. And I do think that sometimes people can imagine themselves immune to sexism and racism and perpetuate mm-hmm. it, by thinking that, oh, I'm so above it that when I make the racist joke, it's not really that way. But we are making those jokes around a lot of people who really do hold these views, and we do sort of perpetuate the stereotypes a bit. So I worry about that. But what I would say to the intent is not magic people is that when someone gets upset and says, I didn't intend it, at that moment, I think we just have to really be psychologically realistic here. At that moment, that person feels a great threat that they're going to be seen as an immoral, terrible person, a racist, a sexist. And sometimes the social justice side acts like nobody cares about being seen as immoral. You know, nobody cares about being called a racist or a sexist. That doesn't hurt anyone. We have to recognize that it does hurt them. And if you send the message to them that we're going to pummel you and tell you you're a terrible person over that racist or sexist thing you just said, they have two choices. They have the choice to either prove the thing they said wasn't sexist or racist, and therefore they're not a terrible person, or they have the choice to accept that they're a terrible person. And nobody wants to do either of those things. So if you say you're a terrible person for what you just said, you've just given them an incentive to fight to the death that what they just said wasn't sexist or racist.
Right. Right. It also seems to me that it's not just a strategic question that you want to give people an incentive to change their mind and admit fault. It seems that there's also a question of fairness in that, you know, the situation in which you sort of were being malicious or just like knowingly causing harm is a different situation from the one in which you unknowingly or accidentally caused harm. And you may still need sort of owe people an apology in the latter case, but it's a very different, you've done a very different like moral crime in the second case than in the former case. And so when people protest, you know, but just to be clear, I had no idea it would be interpreted that way, or I didn't mean it that way. I think they're trying to eke out a pretty reasonable position there, while still hopefully, you know, acknowledging if they should have known better or something.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't mean to just be strategic, because I would also add that it's really wrong and unfair to people to say, well, number one, that this one action is the sum of who you are, so therefore
sure.
We can call you.
Yeah.
Right? You need a lot of evidence before you call someone a racist or a sexist, but you can say that was a racist or a sexist thing and separate it from them as a person. So I do see, though, a room for that there is a little bit of a bite at them, because it does seem too easy if, well, they don't mean anything bad, therefore we just let it go. So we do have to kind of recognize that if there's no stigma, then it becomes just too easy for everyone's always brushing it off, right? And marginalized people kind of have to brush it off all day. So it gets a little bit unfair to them when the one time that they're finally like, I'm fed up with this crap, and they lash out, that they get, you know, then it's, well, I didn't mean it. So we kind of have to have a balance where we're not saying, that you're a terrible person because of this mistake, and it's just as bad as if you meant it. But we also have to have the discussion about how it could be really a problem. And the other thing is that there tends to be, but also if we're not allowing for the honest mistake, then a lot of people feel like, well, I'm going to be pummeled and I don't even know what's coming, right? And that's a disaster too, because now they feel like those who are attacking them are capricious. And the last part about this, social justice arguments really hinge on the idea that these problems are systemic. And I really agree with that, that it's not about a bunch of racists getting together to do racist things. It's about systematic procedures of things that were put in place by racists and still operate, and an implicit logic of marginalization and all sorts of racist prejudices, which are very unconscious and demonstrated, that those sorts of things are the problem. And I think what happens sometimes is the social justice movement will fixate on an individual and lose sight of the point that it's not about that individual, it's about the systemic issues. And pummeling that individual as a scapegoat, as the source of all evil, is a huge, it's not fair, like you say, it's dishonest.
Right. Well, systematic issues don't have faces or names and are much harder to target, make much less natural villains, I guess, than a person. So I think at this point, maybe it would be good to circle back to the original conversation we had on Facebook that that inspired this whole episode. Probably many of our listeners are aware that about a week ago, the Northeast Conference on Science and Skepticism, where I've attended and spoken for the last few years, rescinded their invitation to Richard Dawkins, who had been the keynote speaker at the conference, because he had tweeted a link to a video that it was a pretty crass satire video that was basically making the argument that feminist ideology is kind of equivalent or has a lot of parallels to Islamist ideology. So Dawkins was disinvited. And I think there's a number of interesting angles on this controversy, one of which being the rather uncivil tone of the video and whether or not that was inappropriate and, you know, why or why not. But the one that I want to jump in on first is, so a fair amount of the discussion on my Facebook post was about whether the video was misogynist and or racist. And I think now that we've been talking about, you know, attacking issues instead of individuals, I think it can be pretty difficult to separate an attack on an ideology from an attack on people. So, for example, there was a caricature of an Islamist and a caricature of a feminist, who was in fact a caricature of a real feminist, although I think Dawkins didn't know that when he posted it. And so I think the, you know, they were not very flattering caricatures, of course. But I sort of have to wonder what takes a critique of an ideology like feminism or Islamism over the line where it becomes a critique of women or a critique of Muslims or of Arabs. Do you have any heuristics for settling those issues?
So my take on the situation in general, why we disagreed, was about Dawkins being disinvited over it.
Right. Oh, I guess I didn't actually say what our positions were. I just sort of pointed at the issues.
Yes.
Would it be easier for me to just lay out what my original Facebook post said and you can respond as you did on Facebook? Okay. All right. So what I said on Facebook, it's a public post. I can link to it if you want to read it. Which I only mostly agree with now, not entirely. But what I said at the time is, you know, I did not like the satirical video. I thought it was crass and immature and intellectually lazy, and I don't think Dawkins should have posted it. However, I still nevertheless disagree with the Nexus decision to disinvite Dawkins because of the video. And it's not because I think they were censoring his free speech or anything like that. I think, you know, a conference has a perfect right to disinvite a speaker if they feel like he's not appropriate for the conference or for the audience. I objected because I felt like the sort of crassness and unfairness and intellectual laziness of the video was not really any different from the kind of crassness and intellectual laziness that I see in a lot of skeptic and atheist satires and even just blog posts aimed at, say, Christians or homeopaths or even particular people within the skeptic or atheist community with whom the author disagrees. And so it seemed to me that disinviting Dawkins because the video he posted was crass and unproductive and immature was kind of a double standard, in that those same kinds, that same tone, that same level of discourse seems to be in practice considered fine unless it's directed at, say, feminism. I can talk about how my views have shifted a little bit since then, but maybe why don't you just jump in and say what you disagreed with in that, Dan?
Yeah, so what I disagreed with was, so the first thing is that I do think it matters that Richard Dawkins is not just any speaker. I think that if you invite Matt and Trey from South Park, they represent, or the Charlie Hebdo guys, they are, you know, honest, you know, they're clear about what they are, right? Their credibility is as satirists. They're not as leaders of a movement. They're not as, you know, someone who's on the board of the most important, one of the most important and powerful secular organizations in the country. You know, I think that the nature of Dawkins's power means that he's seen as the face of the entire movement. When he does things, it reflects on all of us, whether we like that or not. And I don't think it's rational for us, I don't think it's rational for Dawkins to ignore the laws of human psychology and say, oh, no, no, if I call it just my personal Twitter feed, then I'm not representing anybody else. I think that that's irresponsible about how he's actually representing everybody. And so because of that, I think that's different. Does that make sense?
I think so, but just to ask a clarifying question, does that imply that if he had posted a video with the same sort of level of tone, but about a different target, say Christians or homeopaths, that it would still have been unacceptable because of his role in the movement, his prominence?
Well, he said things about Muslims that have upset even many people in the movement and that are ostensibly, you know, like he's offended people by saying the Muslim world has no Nobel Prize winners in science or very few. Like, he has upset other atheists even when he was attacking religion.
But he didn't get disinvited from a conference for it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to see him getting disinvited here as sort of, look, it's a threshold issue, right? You allow people a certain number of, if we're going to call them mistakes, I think they're mistakes. You allow someone a certain number of mistakes because they're only human. At a certain point, you know, there's no clear line, right? At a certain point, you say, okay, we're fed up, right? Now, I agree. To me, any CSS, you know, maybe just shouldn't have invited him in the first place. It is weird to do it over one video. But it isn't just one video. It is that finally they took into account the whole history.
Although I think it's possible I'm misinterpreting their position. I think that their position was not that his incivility in general, including towards Christians or Muslims, is that is the thing that has accumulated enough to cause us to disinvite him. I thought it was his incivility in critiquing feminism.
It could be. I mean, well, so let me get to that prong of my argument. So that's a nice setup. So the next prong of my argument was the other issue is that NECSS isn't trying to bring in homeopaths to their conference. It's not, and you know, it's not trying to bring in pseudoscientists. It's not. It also doesn't represent the values of homeopaths, etc. Whereas I do think that I do think that the skeptic movement is or should be part of the humanist movement. And I do think it's fine for skeptic organizations to say humanist values include feminism and that the kind of vitriol in the video was towards mainstream feminism. I mean, you can say that, oh no, it was about this, it's only about that segment of feminists who are apologists for Islam, even when Islam is harming women. And I agree, that is a serious problem. I am friends with many ex-Muslims and my heart goes out to them. And I really, really believe that sometimes, I'll give you a great example of this. I got into a big fight on Facebook attacking a kind of feminist who apologizes for Islam when they shouldn't. Like, I was pointed to a video in which a feminist Muslim explained how she wears the hijab completely out of her preference, and it's because she believes that it makes her more dignified to not be a sexualized object. And to me, feminists are, you know, mainstream Western feminism would call that kind of modesty position patriarchal, because it puts the emphasis on women to be the ones who don't get themselves objectified by being more modest. And it puts the emphasis on men being these uncontrollable dogs who, if they see a woman's hair, they will objectify her. You know, like, I don't think that's feminism, and I don't think just because it's a Muslim woman who's claiming she's being a feminist by saying that becomes feminism. And I do think that feminists have done a bad job sometimes in defending the women in the Middle East against a patriarchal culture, and they've been condescending and patted them on the head. And I think they've put their anti-colonialism, which is a good thing in general, above their feminism. So I think that's valid. But the problem was this video was lumping in anything related to feminism as inherently this, you know, as bad as Islamism. And it was so crude to be completely alienating to anybody who sees themselves as part of the actual feminist, revival going on in the internet that I think these organizations don't see themselves as against and want to have a hospitable environment towards those people, even if there's disagreements among them. There should be that kind of they should be welcome.
Right, right. Yeah, it does. And this is probably a good point to bring up one of the ways that my viewpoint shifted after the long comment thread that followed my original Facebook post, in part because of some things Dan said and a few other commenters as well. I think I can get on board with the idea that there should be different standards for how sort of careful or civil you should be expected to be, depending on what the target of your criticism is. And I haven't worked out exactly what I think those, you know, differences should depend on, but I can see an argument for, you know, if the target of your criticism is a marginalized group, or is associated with a marginalized group, maybe, or the target of your criticism is something, is a group that like could reasonably feel unwelcome in your community or movement because of your criticism, then maybe the standard for civility should be higher, which is not what I had argued in my original post. So that is kind of a shift for me. But the thing that I'm still confused about is whether my disagreement with you, Dan, the original disagreement, is mainly over whether we think that Dawkins posting that video was him satirizing or slamming feminism in general, which I think is like I think the sort of core tenets of feminism are like really they're so almost like moral like fundamentals, at least in our sort of the humanist community, like the idea that, you know, women should have equal rights and no woman deserves to be raped and, you know, women should be paid the same for the same work and all, like women should have the right to vote and all of those things. Like, even if you're civil in criticizing those things, that's still a pretty hostile, that does create a hostile environment for women, I think. However, Dawkins, he is sort of explicitly trying to separate out those core tenets of feminism, which he supports, from the more fringe parts of the feminist movement, like the parts that are, you know, often apologists for Islam and its mistreatment of women. And so I guess my question for you is whether you think Dawkins' fault was in not separating cleanly enough the target of his criticism away from feminism in general, and thereby creating a hostile environment for women, because it felt like he was attacking, maybe he was sort of indirectly attacking by linking to that video, which didn't make the distinction, the sort of basic rights of women. Or whether you think that, no, even if the video had said this is just about fringe feminists, that critiquing fringe feminists maybe in an uncivil way, that sort of justifiably makes women feel unwelcome.
Yeah, does that make sense? Yeah, it does. I mean, I don't think he's only attacking a fringe. I think that he's attacking a very large segment of feminists who do think that the kind of feminism that he identifies with doesn't go far enough. Now, I want to be clear, because I'm sure his fans are chopping at the bit right now to mention this. He does say in linking to the video that this is not all feminists. In fact, the vast majority don't like that. Right?
Exactly.
And okay, I'll give him that. I think, though, the problem, the video is not nearly as clear. And Dawkins' hostility is against more than just a fringe. I mean, I don't know if it's, I'm going to bring in a previous tweet. When he writes, "Officer, it's not my fault I was drunk driving. You see, somebody got me drunk." When he's defending, when he's on a rampage because of the, about rape accusations, over people being drunk and having non-consensual sex, and calling that rape afterwards, he writes this tweet, which says, again, "Officer, it's not my fault I was drunk driving. You see, somebody got me drunk." He's going after there something that I don't think is just a fringe. The idea that there is rape from women, you know, that people can be raped because they're taken advantage of when they're drunk. And that kind of victim blaming in here, the kind of pattern of hostility here towards positions which are defensible, is a problem. And I think the other thing is to call this fringe feminism, the other problem I have with it is that the ostensive purpose of this was to satirize, as I understand it, what was going on in Cologne, where there were a number of sexual assault reports on New Year's mm-hmm. Eve. And apparently it was some sort of coordinated, you know, the thing by Middle Eastern, you know, people from Muslim descent, you know, Muslim countries descent. And there was this huge thing in the media. Why aren't the feminists calling this out? Right. It's because they don't think it's rape if it's by a Muslim. That's the joke in that video. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in that case, what you're looking at is feminists were put, people who were very disingenuous were putting feminists in a bind. They were like, huh, don't you want to, you know, you don't want to pick on Muslims, do you? You know, yeah. And it's like, no, they're not being hypocrites. Like if you were in to be extreme about it, but if you were in 1930s Germany and you found out about some really bad things done by a group of Jews, you know, you don't go and like, when you know that the Nazis are about to clamp down and commit, horrendous things against the Jews, you don't want to stoke a fascist flame. It's a worse consequence if you do that. And I totally understand that no feminist came out and said, well, it's just Muslims, it's not rape. They didn't say that. What they said was, hello, don't use these sexual assaults to stoke the fascist backlash against Muslim immigrants that's happening in Europe and in the United States. And so to satirize those feminists as saying it's not rape if a Muslim does it, as that video said, that's mm-hmm. disgusting.
So I guess I want to give you the opportunity, if there's something that we didn't touch on that you think should be said, to introduce, you know, the last thread. But if not, I can just ask you another question.
I just feel like I didn't answer your question well enough. I'll just admit to you, I do think you have a really good point. In fact, when I was looking back at the discussion, I remember saying, I don't know how to answer that. And then you brought it up again here. And that point is, yeah, what's the difference between attacking a woman and attacking feminism, right?
Right.
And I do think you're right. Like, political movements can be skewered. It's not like picking on women. And I guess you could satirize Black Lives Matter without picking on black people, but it is...
It would be tricky to do.
It's tricky to do.
That is a very, very fine needle to thread.
It's a very fine needle to thread, and I think that one thing I've picked up from the feminist blogosphere is sometimes if we actually look at the latitude we give to our criticism to feminism that we wouldn't give to our criticism of anti-racism... Mm-hmm. Like we do seem a little bit more forgiving of sexism and misogyny, and I do think maybe that's telling that we would see a black satirization of black activism as an attack on black people. There is a blurry, you know, it's a similar kind of thing with attacking feminism too carelessly. And finally, the one thing I think I did make a point with you was that it was a real woman in the video. And even though Dawkins in his official thing said, oh, I've scrubbed because I found out it was a real person, he went on to deny maybe she hasn't really gotten all that vitriol she's saying, but I decided to tweet around, you know, to scrub it anyway. Then he congratulated himself because, you know, no one should be harassed, even a vile person like her. Maybe, you know, like every life matters, even a vile one like her. And it's like, you know, to call a street level activist, and I found that really hypocritical because you know, the anti-feminist side has gotten upset over Twitter storms over powerful people making sexist remarks, like Sam Harris saying, you know, estrogen vibe is not as good in atheism, that's why women aren't, you know, like jokes that are, of course, he was kidding, but the point is, like, these sorts of jokes, they, you know, the anti-feminist side has not really been kind about, you know, has not been happy about those people being raked through the mud. People like Sam Harris or the scientist, who said that you don't want girls in the laboratory because they cry and they fall in love with you. Like, those guys, they've said, oh, they just pummeled them for a joke, you know. But meanwhile, here's Dawkins being told that there's a street-level activist who, of course, I mean, look, she was very uncivil. I hate that video. It's terrible. I don't support her. But She doesn't deserve to be the face of all that's evil with feminism. And Dawkins, even after was alerted about that, started denying that she's gotten any abuse, called her vile. For what? For being an incendiary activist who gets out of control? You mean like Dawkins has been fighting that atheists can be? I find that really problematic and hypocritical for the anti-feminist side, that they are so against witch hunts if it's Sam Harris, but if it's, you know, who can more than take care of himself, but if it's a street level activist who's on the feminist side, and that's where I think that their claim that they're just about civility and free speech are hypocritical. I'm trying to really chart the course that's really fair to both sides in my civility pledge, and I don't find that that side is really that fair to the feminist side. And of course, I know the feminist side can be abusive. They're wrong as often as they're right, I think. But I just don't like when people are taking themselves, wrapping themselves in free speech and declaring themselves the winners any more than people who take themselves and wrap themselves in social justice and say they're the winners. And both of these sides are not listening to each other because they think they can do no wrong because they're on the side of justice. And I want to actually look at claim by claim by claim. No privilege is not the end of the story. We have to actually prove the argument's wrong, not just that you're wrong because you have privilege. And no, you know, just saying I have a right to offend is not the end of the story. When you offend, people can actually make an argument that it was a moral reason they got offended and that they have a right against you to get an apology.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are just about out of time. This seems like a good point at which to close this section of the podcast. But I want to say, before we close this section, how much I appreciate your style of engagement and the level of nuance that you bring to these arguments. As I think I said at the beginning, I even when I disagree with you, although I don't think we disagree that much, I feel like I have more in common or more important things in common with you than I do with people who like happen to have the same object level position as I do on a particular issue, but think it's like a clear cut case and anyone who disagrees is a moron. So I guess then the last thing I'll say is that the kind of thing that I really like about your civility pledge and your sort of general approach to discourse, of which the civility pledge is a manifestation, is I like to think of these two common approaches to sort of controversial moral disagreements, where one approach is just to get angry and hurl invectives at each other and demonize the other side, which is clearly not good. Then the second common approach is sort of a reaction to that first approach, and it's to say, look, let's just live and let live. Let's be tolerant of each other. Let's not, you know, attack each other for our views. Let's just let people agree to disagree, basically. And I think that is an improvement over the first, but I think we can still do better. I think that ideally we can sort of appreciate that these issues are important and should be discussed. And, you know, in theory, if I'm wrong about on, you know, my position on some of these important issues, I would like to find out that I'm wrong. And that requires actually hearing people's criticisms of my position. And that's much harder to do while not falling, collapsing back down into the first approach. But I really appreciate your efforts to try to push us towards that third strategy.
Thanks. And yeah, the admiration is mutual. Like, in fact, I literally had been thinking it would be neat to be able to come on your show someday, the morning you actually wrote me. I was so excited.
Ah, that's wonderful. Fantastic. All right. So I will wrap up this section of the podcast and we'll move on now to the Rationally Speaking pick. Welcome back. Every episode, we invite our guest on Rationally Speaking to introduce the pick of the episode. That's a book or website or movie or something that influenced his or her thinking in an interesting way. So, Dan, what's your pick for today's episode?
I'm going to go with a wonderful anthology on meta-ethics called Excellent. The Foundations of Ethics. And it's edited by Schaefer Landau and Terence Cuneo, Russ Schaefer Landau and Terence Cuneo. And it is an anthology covering most of the leading philosophy scholarship and moral philosophy from the, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, and the early 2000s. And it was one of the books that has a lot of articles that really opened my eyes to the philosophical complexities of that, that philosophers have really figured out in the foundations of ethics. And I feel like so much of our public discourse acts like there is no good thought out there about moral foundations. It's all, we just either have to punt over to religion or just turn it into a brain science of cognitive science. There is a lot of really, really good thought that's been done in the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. And I think that anthology has a number of papers that proved that to me and changed my views and really influenced them in countless ways. So I would recommend that anthology for anyone who really wants to know what philosophers have to offer to the question of the foundation of ethics.
Excellent. In fact, when I first started the podcast with Massimo, I was somewhat inhabiting this persona of being like anti-philosophy in general, like, feel, you know, arguing that philosophy was pointless or worthless or something, which I think was all along somewhat of a caricature of my actual position. But it is true, I was pretty skeptical of most philosophy. And I don't know what the particular papers are in the anthology, but I will say that reading Metaethics is one of the things that shifted me more towards the position that, okay, fine, there's a fair amount of philosophy out there that's tackling like meaningful, important questions in useful ways. So I'll be checking your pick out, is what I'm trying to say. Great. Well, we'll link to the pick as well as to your blog on the podcast website, and maybe also to our original Facebook conversation. Dan, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a real honor.
This concludes another episode of Rationally Speaking. Join us next time for more explorations on the borderlands between reason and nonsense.
The Rationally Speaking podcast is presented by New York City Skeptics. For program notes, links, and to get involved in an online conversation about this and other episodes, please visit rationallyspeakingpodcast.org. This podcast is produced by Benny Pollack and recorded in the heart of Greenwich Village, New York. Our theme, Truth, by Todd Rundgren, is used by permission. Thank you for listening.